Well, the 10 steps plan is very important because it's quite intuitive, right? When you have a 10 steps and very concrete steps, then you can follow that. This is, I would say, also kind of educational tool. So it can be also adapted at the medical schools, you know, when you teach migraine diagnosis and management. And the idea was also, it is important for the primary care.
Ever wonder what playbook your doctor is referencing before recommending a treatment plan for your migraine care? So do we. You know, for decades, physicians have only had some general guidelines from the medical societies to reference before choosing from dozens of pharmaceutical, behavioral, device, and lifestyle approaches. And that all changed this year when a team of European researchers published an evidence-based 10-step approach for migraine management. It might just give you and your physician a roadmap for how to get control of your pain and other symptoms. Joining us today to explain the 10 steps to migraine management is one of the study's authors and the most recent past president of the International Headache Society, Dr. Masoud Ashina. Dr. Ashina, welcome to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you, Paula. Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us, when was this 10-step plan developed? And how?
Well, that was some years ago. In fact, inspired by some of my junior scientists, I was told that why don't we do 10 steps for migraine? Because they found literature on other diseases, and they say, well, this is something we're missing. And you know, if you want to be, contemporary, you have to listen to what your junior scientists are telling you. And they say that this is something missing and you have to look at it. First I said, well, I'm too busy about that. But then say, no, you have to read some literature. Then I read the literature and I must admit that I was impressed by their persistence. And I say, well, let's do it. So the first step was that we had some brainstorming. We would like to have it, friendly, you know, the 10 steps so that everybody can apply that. Of course, you know, based on some experience on the literature. But we also found out that we need a consensus statement, okay? Because not everything is evidence-based. And it is important to have a consensus statement, but as a one society or the one center, we cannot just present 10 steps. We need some partners and experts from the different countries. So we decided, we initiated as a project from the Danish Headache Society, and then we approached European Headache Federation and European Academy of Neurology, and we suggested that this is a consensus statement, and it would be great if they also endorse this consensus statement. The next step was to invite our colleagues from the different countries. As you see from the list, and they're coming from European countries, and also some of them known in the field, some of them new in the field. So it should be a nice combination of the experience and junior, and of course also representing also genders here. It was also very important for us. And after that, I submitted synopsis to the journal, and they found the idea great, and they say, okay, let's do it. So that was a quite long process, but very, very interesting process, because you can imagine with so many people, so many different opinions, but we agreed this is important, and this is all about that. So eventually we became friends.
That's great.
All the authors. Yeah, that was the story of that. Yeah.
I have been to enough medical conferences where I can completely imagine how challenging it must have been to get alignment on this. And you are part of the world-renowned Danish Headache Center in Denmark, where you practice, and you got it adopted in Europe and published in Nature Reviews Neurology. Any reason this shouldn't be adopted worldwide?
Well, at that time, you know, I thought that, you know, we have to do it fast, and we have to act. And I didn't have a time, you know, to think about that. But when you're now asking me about that, I think that it would be great also to have something, maybe in some years ahead, of a more broad consensus, embracing not only European countries, but also outside of Europe. It could be North America, Latin America, Southeast Asia. I think it's important. In fact, I did something, you know, you can call it kind of a global paper. I published a series of papers in Lancet this year, three papers. And one first paper was about systems of care, and it was about the migrant epidemiology. That was quite broad. We had authors from the different countries representing not only Europe, but also Brazil, China, North America, Middle East. I mean, it was a really great project. But in this case, only European. But I think that in the future, you just gave me a good idea. So I will probably use this idea and try to do some update, let's say in 5 years or 10 years. We'll see.
Great. So why was it important to create a 10-step plan?
Well, the 10-step plan is very important because it's quite intuitive, right? When you have a 10 steps and very concrete steps, then you can follow that. This is, I would say, also kind of educational tool. So it can be also adapted at the medical schools, you know, when you teach the migraine diagnosis and management. And the idea was also, it is important for the primary care, because the most of the migraine patients we are talking are seen by our general practitioners, and they need something very concrete, because as you know, the GPs are quite busy. They don't have hours and hours sitting there with their patients and discussing the migraine diagnosis and management. Should be quite fast track and clear cut. So just, you know, with a simple first step, you know, when to suspect migraine, you know, it's very easy. And we give them this, you know, opportunity with a very deductive, I would say, clear cut bullet points that this is the way you do it. If you are interested to read it more, you can read the whole paper. But what we decided that it was important also to have a kind of figure or table showing these 10 steps. So primarily for the GPs.
Primarily for the GPs, but as I looked at the plan, I thought it would be very useful for many neurologists as well, because of the rate of misdiagnosis and the percentage of people who are getting who aren't getting preventive care, who really should be on preventive care. Is that right?
Absolutely agree, Paula. This is also very important. Unfortunately, you know, for many years, a migraine and headache diagnosis in general was kind of underrepresented in neurology, not so popular in neurology. But now, you know, with more science, more new treatments, especially biologics, you know, coming into our practice, we're changing the field, right? And this is a momentum. And that's why I also thought of using this momentum to provide also this step, you know, 10 steps diagnosis and management, not only for the GPs, and as you said, also for our colleagues in neurology, outpatient clinics. It could be also for the practicing neurologists, you know, the private neurologists. They also need that, because according to some data that we have, 25% of the cases in the general practice, neurology general practice, are about headache. And we know that the vast majority of the patients are suffering from migraine. So that's why this field is also important, and it is a focus, and these 10 steps can be used there as well.
It's very important. I encourage people when they go to see their GP, even if they have a neurologist or a specialist who's taking care of them, have the conversation about migraine, because many of our patient advocates really know much more about migraine even than their GP, or at least different spheres of knowledge. Now, migraine is so varied in its expression. Could one approach possibly work for all types of migraine?
This is a very good question, Paula. The problem is that we have also rare subtypes of migraine. I would say that these rare subtypes of migraine, I mean, you can't easily use these 10 steps in these rare subtypes. Let's say if you have a familiar hemiplegic migraine. So this is not a case that you can use the 10 steps. It's a more specialized task for the specialist in headache medicine. They should see these patients. So this is, as I said, more straightforward for the common types of migraine with and without aura.
Okay, that's great. So while there's 10 steps, there are actually three major phases into which those 10 steps fall: the diagnosis, treatment, and then follow-up care. So I want to unpack each one of those individually with you. Let's start with diagnosis, where all things begin. The first step is when to suspect migraine and what's important. Are light sensitivity or nausea relevant here?
Yeah, the so-called migraine features such as a light sensitivity, sound sensitivity is important. But what is important is to understand that the migraine is a recurrent disorder, okay? It comes and goes, okay? We call it also paroxysmal disorder. It's self-limiting and it's very stereotyped. And this raise eyebrows and say, well, this is something about, you know, primary disorder, not a secondary disorder. And if this primary disorder with a recurrent, let's say, characteristics also associated with some of the classical features of migraine, photophobia, phonophobia, light sensitivity, and sound sensitivity, and one important also point, disability during the attack, okay? So you are, you know, I'm a migraineur myself, so I know that when you have a migraine, you don't want to, you know, walk around. You want to stay still or you want to lay down. So this is a very characteristics for migraine. And then you suspect the migraine. And then there is also some other symptoms which can, in fact, how to say, strengthen your confidence in diagnosis, such as gender. We know that it's a more prevalent in women than in men. Age. We also know about the genetics of migraine. You can ask about the family history. Do you have any relatives, first degree relatives suffering from any recurrent headaches? Well, then you have suddenly all these symptoms together, plus history. And history is taken. You know, you have to ask these questions. Then you have a diagnosis. One important point is also, of course, it requires also knowledge about the diagnostic criteria, right? But if you follow these steps, if you follow these logics, then it's very easy to confirm that with the diagnostic criteria, which is available online, absolutely free. Everybody can see. So you can confirm your diagnosis, you know, in 5 minutes, something like that, after you have, of course, collected all the data.
Got it. So step two is the diagnosis of migraine. And you talked about a number of the criteria there. But is there anything else you look for? And is neuroimaging appropriate?
Neuroimaging is appropriate if you have patients with some neurological deficit. Usually, we neurologists will look for focal signs. If patients have any focal signs, which is some serious signs, you know, could be due to the secondary headache, then we must react immediately and we have to refer patient to the neuroimaging. But if you do a good history of patients, you know, you collected the good history and you do the neurological examination, which is a must also during the first visit. And this neurological examination should be focused neurological examination, right? Not necessarily including all aspects of neurological examination, but important focused one. And you can exclude the secondary headache. You don't need imaging. But if you can't exclude, and if something also, your gut feeling says that this is something wrong and there's some red flags here, and we have a list of red flags, then you refer the patient to the neuroimaging. But in the most of the cases, the vast majority of cases, you don't need imaging.
Well said. So step three, I'm a big fan of patient centricity and education, probably often skipped in actual practice. But how important is it to set reasonable expectations?
I would say step three is essential follow-up, because when the patients come into my office, you know, most of them are very concerned about their condition. And they are concerned that some of them to think that too many migraine attacks, brain damage, you know, what's happening? Why can't you just find the reason of my migraine and I can get rid of the migraine and you can cure me? Well, I say, well, I wish I can cure your migraine. And this kind of educational aspect of the patient centricity and education coming together is important. We have to spend some time to explain them about the migraine, you know, and also to provide appropriate reassurance that here we have a condition which can be managed, but of course there is no guarantee, but we will do our best to manage your condition. And also realistic objectives, you know, sometimes when it's a very chronic, I would say very frequent, you know, even 30% reduction, you know, in terms of the frequency or intensity or duration of the migraine attacks can be a result. So we have to be also realistic about that, right? And talking about the trigger factors, it is something that, in on one hand, we can do something about that. And on the other hand, maybe we can't do that because trigger factors are very, how to say, complex, because some of them not trigger really factors because they are not really consistent. And just telling the patients, avoid this, we can also impair their quality of life. So this is also important. And also the strategy, you know, should be individualized because patients are unique. Each patient is unique. And there are so many other aspects we have to take it into account when we start planning the treatment. So I would say step three is very, very important.
And it's also where you're setting expectations about what success might be. If somebody walks into your office and they're looking for a cure and you tell them, hey, success is going to be, I'm going to give you a few days of your life back. And maybe we can unwind some of this pain that you're experiencing and some of the symptoms you're experiencing. That's got to be a challenging conversation for a physician to have.
It's absolutely a challenging conversation, but if you spend some time and you show empathy and you take it seriously, you know, believe me, you get a really good alliance with the patients, you know, and their compliance will be also great, you know, in the absolutely most of the cases, because they are very, focused on their condition, and they really want to change that. So realistic expectations are very important. And we talk about that and we say, well, we cannot cure that. You know, I wish I could cure that. But if I can change frequency, this is a success. If I can't change the frequency, I can change the intensity. So your attacks are less intense in terms of the severity. It is also a result for me and also for the patient and also for the duration. So instead of having, let's say, 4 or 5 days lasting attacks or 3 days lasting attack, you can shrink that to 1 day. That is also a success.
It is. It can be life-changing for many people. So step four is what often gets all the attention, the acute treatment. Is there any reason why everyone shouldn't use something like a triptan or a diptan or a gepant? You know, or is there a role for devices in treating attacks?
You see, Paulo, first of all, why acute treatment is important, and it is in fact also before the preventive treatment. I must admit, we experienced clinical neurologists and headache experts, we sometimes forget asking, you know, patients about the acute treatment. We focus so much on prevention because our group is very selective, there's a very frequent attacks, and we forget about the acute treatment and importance of acute treatment, and importance also to optimize the acute treatment, because not everybody is happy with the first line medications that we showed in our article. For instance, NSAIDs, you know, they could be effective. You know, the diclofenac, potassium could be very effective. But in case that it's not effective, you have to think about the triptans. How is it possible, after 30 years of having triptans in the market, we still have a quite large number group of patients never tried triptans or tried only one triptan? And with the invention, introduction of the new medications such as GPANs and DTANs, we will be forced to try triptans, you know, because of the reimbursement rules, it could be different things. And in the most of the cases, of course, and this is very important. That's why the optimization of acute treatment, it should be something every neurologist and also GP must remember. And if patients are not responding to triptans, they tried some of the triptans, or they have a contraindications or they cannot tolerate, at least in some countries, we have now new drugs and they open up for new possibilities. Gepants, DTANs, lasmiditan is one of the DTANs. It's only one, in fact. So we can use that. And many people also asking for the medication, for nausea or vomiting, you know, during the attacks. Not because it can enhance your effect of the acute medication such as triptans or NSAIDs. It's just because it works. And it can also help your patient, intake the medication, you know, the oral medication, because they have so severe, let's say, nausea or vomiting. So acute treatments is very, very important. About other modalities, we didn't put here, you ask about the neuromodulations. Well, in the most of the cases, again, you can manage that. And there is so much room for improvement only for this step, you can't imagine, Paula. So that's why this is a focus, and we focus mostly here on the pharmacological treatments. But there are some studies showing that there might be some effect of the neuromodulation. But I would say that based on the evidence and therapeutic gain, so we focused on pharmacological here.
Right. And we should say that every year there are new therapies coming out. There's a new one this year that's a DHE device that's used in the nasal cavity. So this is an area where there's continued development, as well as step five, preventive. We're getting new preventive options every year. Talk about why CGRPs are considered third line for preventives.
Yeah, I would say the reason that the CGRP monoclonal antibodies are considered as the third line medications in our step five is only because of the price. Because these medications are very expensive. In an ideal world, if the price is not means nothing, you know, they could be used as a first line, because these medications are designed, developed for migraine prevention, right? All other medications are non-specific. We discovered some years ago that it might work in some migraine patients. Then the study's been conducted, so-called randomized clinical trials, and they showed that those medications are better than placebo, and that's why we use them for many years. You know, it's evidence-based. But monoclonal antibodies are specifically designed for migraine, but because of the reimbursement, because of the regulations, and also some of the consensus guidelines, they should be used as the third line medication. Another reason is also because this medication, in spite of the excellent data coming from the phase 3 studies as well on safety and tolerability, we only start learning about these medications in the clinical practice. So it might take some years, you know, where everybody's confident about their efficacy, safety, tolerability in the real world population. But data is accumulating. Right now, we're seeing many people are collecting this data and our confidence increases. But again, back to the countries, individual, let's say, regulations, this makes at case a little bit complicated. That's why they are on the third line.
Well, we have a whole talk on preventive care, but I do want to ask you why this step is so important and why it's often missed.
The preventive medication is very important because, I can give you one example. You know, let's say that if somebody is suffering from migraine 2 days a week, only 2 days a week, all other days I'm completely migraine free, right? For 1 month, it makes 8 days, right? So all 8 days, I try acute medications and they don't work. Or they work, but I stay in the bed. I want to go out, you know, all the time, you know, the anticipation, you know, that it might come, you know, if I'm planning something drives me crazy. And if you multiply that by 12 months, you have a 96 days of migraine. All other days, you're completely free. But 96 days, can you imagine? You just take off from your calendar. They don't exist in your life, 96 days. And that could be in the most productive years of your life. Now, if you can't provide this patient with the preventive medications, with a chance of reducing by the 50% or 75%, it's absolutely crazy. I mean, it's our duty, and we have to do that. So that's why this step is very, very important, that you take it into account frequency, you take into account the disability associated with migraine and previous failures, and then you act. You have to treat them, okay? So, and again, like with the triptans, if you look back and see, even in the countries, let's say, with a quite developed headache medicine, such as US and Denmark, we still have a lot of patients never tried preventive medications. It's unbelievable. So forget about the other countries, you know, and especially if you take the rest of the world, you know, you take it low-income countries, even worse situation there for our patients there, okay? So that's why this step is very important. And by providing some of the first-line medications, such as the beta blockers, which are available in all countries around the world, can you imagine how many people we can help around the world? So it's not only about the rich countries, but also about the rest of the world. You know, this, you know, patients are struggling, you know, and they're fighting with their migraines. They can get these drugs. And some of them are very cheap, such as the beta blockers, let's say. So this is very important step number five.
And thank you so much for bringing up the rest of the world, because we oftentimes talk about things that are available in the U.S., but we reach people in over 90 countries. And there are people all around the world watching what you're saying right now, saying, well, what options do I have and why should I bother with preventive? Is it true that preventive also helps your acute medication work better?
Yeah, this is let's say, some clinical impression that we have. So they work better. But the most important thing, it's preventive medications not only working on the reduction of frequency, intensity, and duration, but also working on reduction of number of days where you take acute medications. And why it's important? Because by taking less acute medication, you can also avoid so-called medication overuse. So this is also very important, right? And we don't talk about the, you know, thousands and thousands, you know, dollars or whatever other currencies that people are using for the alternative treatments in this case. So that's why this kind of preventive medications, and in the ideal world that everybody can get an access also for the specifically designed medications for the migraine prevention, that will be great for our patients.
Excellent point. So step six is special populations, older adults, children, pregnant, people with menstrual migraine. What special considerations apply that a physician or patient should think about here?
Yeah, I mean, this is also a very important step, but I would say that this step is, we're going more to the specialized clinics or more the neurologists seeing the patients, because the GPs sometimes they hesitate in this with this group of patients. So they send this group, special population, to the specialist. And here there are some important points. For instance, when we talk about older people, we have to think about the secondary headaches. We have to think that even it's a primary headache, but with the age, we unfortunately have more comorbidities, right? And our tolerability changes over the age. And this is also important to take it into account when we have patients, older patients. And also for all drugs, for most of the drugs almost, you don't have good evidence in this group. Some evidence from some new trials coming in the some subpopulation, people from 60 to 65, something like that. But we also have some patients 75 years old having a migraine, still suffering from migraine, and we need to act. You know, we need to give preventive medications. We need to give an acute medication. Sometimes acute medication is contraindicated. because of the cardiovascular disease, let's say, in one patient. Or this patient could also suffer from other diseases where the other, let's say, preventive medications are contraindicated. And even if it's not contraindicated, how they will react in this special population, we don't know. So here we come. So here we have something like a real-world evidence. So we need to be, we need to do more about so-called registries, you know, especially in the clinics. Because if we can do international registries on this special population, we can learn more about this specific population. Children case, it is even worse, I would say. Why? Because they are quite often undertreated, underdiagnosed. And if they're undertreated, so you just imagine, you know, the puberty, you know, when they start, they have schools, you know, they have to learn. And if you can't do anything for these children, you don't provide them with efficient acute medication, with efficient preventive medication, you are risking to destroy their lives, their plans, their dreams. So that's why it's important population, extremely important population. And also to remember that their presentation, clinical presentation, sometimes can differ, you know, from migraine in adults. It's also very important. And also the role of the environment, the role of the parents, you know, understanding from their side, from the family side. It's not a frequent problem, but it can be a problem. And you have to talk about that. Plus also schools, you know, it's very, very important to talk about with the teachers about that. So this is also very important, you know, and sometimes it's just sufficient for them to go back home and just stay in the bed, you know, and it can also help, you know, even without medication. And also to be aware that they can be treated with acute medications, including some of the, triptans were also being tested in this population, and they are evidence-based, and in terms of the safety, tolerability are good, they can be used. And usually we say we avoid preventive medications, but I think that in this transition, you know, from the puberty, you know, to the adult life, I think sometimes you need the preventive medications. And I do hope that with the new medications that we have now, we'll have more data in this population so we can provide, our children with the preventive medications so they can go on and study and have fun. You know, it's also important for children. Women, during the pregnancy and breastfeeding, I would say, fortunately, it is not so frequent problem because most of the women has wonderful periods, you know, during the pregnancy because the migraine almost goes away, and sometimes they forget about migraine, but unfortunately it comes back again, and it could be challenging, you know, during the breastfeeding, but in terms of treatment, but during the pregnancy we do have some patients having a very frequent migraines. You know, bad migraines in terms of intensity, it's really challenging. And our, treatment possibilities are very limited. We try to avoid preventive medications in few cases. You know, individually we can do that, but this is not something that I would advise the GPs, you know, to do. It's a specialist task. And it should be managed by experts, right? And also, finally, one of the important points, it's a menstrually related or menstrual migraine. Menstrual migraine is about 10 to 15% of, it depends on the status we are talking about, report purely menstrual related migraine. But I see my case in my clinic, it's less than 10% that exclusively during the menstrual cycle, that could be really difficult to manage. Because their migraines, is my impression also, and also my colleagues and also in the literature, it's quite intense in terms of intensity and also not really, you know, good responding, you know, to the preventive medications that we have in terms of the, let's say, proportion of the patients responding. Less, I would say, and also for the acute treatment. So what I'm now look forward to is that I'm looking forward for this the CGRP monoclonal antibodies in this context to see how they work for this specific, let's say, for this special population. So that will be interesting to hear in the future.
That would be some valuable research. So we've talked about the first six steps, which included diagnosis and treatment, and for the last four steps are really focused on follow-up care. So what happens in step seven when you experience treatment failure?
Yeah, in order to prove the treatment failure and also to have a more, let's say, reliable data, we need to use some instruments, and they're quite easy. Using the headache calendars are very easy. It could be a paper calendar. It could be just app on your iPhone. I mean, young people, they tend to use apps, and the older population, they use still paper calendars, but they're very good. In the paper calendar, they can indicate their intensity of their attacks, frequency, and also there is also a place they can put in acute medications. So you can follow on all three parameters, intensity, frequency, and use of the acute medications, okay? And this is very, very important. So when the patient is back, received, let's say, a beta blocker or a topiramate or CGRP monoclonal antibodies, it doesn't matter which treatment, you can follow, you can see effect of the treatment on these particular variables, parameters. And we can also ask the patients about the adverse events. You know, that's why follow-up is very, very important, okay? And when we see something, let's say, failures, then we can also change the strategy. We can change the medication. We don't have to wait ages for that. We can do it pretty fast and trying, again, to find something which will be the optimal for our patient. Again, it's always individual cases, okay? Or sometimes we have a problem, we need to reevaluate our diagnosis, okay? It's not so often, but can be, you know, that we have to reevaluate the diagnosis. So that's why the follow-ups are also important. And also, if we are in the GP, you know, practice, then we can decide whether this patient should be referred to the specialist, okay? Because we can argue that this particular case, diagnostically or treatment-wise, is very complicated and requires a specialist here. It could be also that the cases are particularly difficult because of the, let's say, medication overuse and also comorbidities. It could be anxiety, depression, it could be low back pain or other persistent pain conditions. So making this case difficult to manage in the primary sector, and that's why they need to be referred. So follow-ups, step seven is important.
And you hinted at step eight, managing complications, and step nine, managing comorbidities. Are these things that you feel like GPs can do, or does this really take a specialist?
You know, it all depends. You know, I've seen some GPs with a great interest in headache medicine. So they're really good in that, and they're doing excellent job. But we have to respect also their work. The GPs are very busy, you know. They have a very limited time for their patients, and we have to be realistic. They see all kinds of patients. So to demand too much, I would say it would be unfair, because they're really busy. But as a minimum, you know, if they can manage, let's say, anxiety or depression in this case, and if it's really, let's say, prominent and it is a problem, not necessarily a cause of the migraine, because it can be a cause of migraine, but could be a factor which may chronify migraine. So migraine becomes chronic. So in this case, they can prevent that by treating depression or anxiety. Okay. For the medication overuse, only advice could be sufficient. And this is something GPs, they can do that. Because there is a Norwegian study showing that a population-based study, just advice can change the course of medication overuse headache. So the drops just with a simple advice. So that's why it's very, very important. And also, complicated cases, I would say, they cannot, they don't have time for that. They need to be referred to the specialist care.
Yes. And step 10, we don't want to underestimate long-term follow-up, which really means consistent follow-up, right? Because migraine is not going to just go away. Is there a point at which it's appropriate to return to the care of a GP after seeing a specialist?
I started by saying that almost 90% of the patients, of migraine patients, they must be seen by the GPs, and they can be managed in the GP practice. This is let's say, the optimal dream situation. But if the patients are in the specialist care, we need to have a long-term plan. It's very, very important. And again, being fair to our colleagues, the general practice, we need to provide them a clear-cut plan about the step one, two, three, four, what to do in this case. So when they go back to the GP, they can manage that easily. Okay. They might try some other medications. They may take the patients, let's say, increase the dose if it's necessary. So there could be many possibilities for the GPs, to play around a little bit with the treatment, while we can see other patients that are already, they also needed, they need to come to the specialist to see. Because otherwise, our waiting list will be huge, because taking into account the prevalence of migraine, it will be impossible, to manage them all in the specialist care. So it's very important, we have a long-term plan in primary care. So they're going back to this with a comprehensive plan. If this comprehensive plan, let's say, fails and there is still room for improvement, let's say because the new medications are there and patients never tried that, but the GPs are not, let's say, allowed to prescribe this medication, or they don't want to prescribe this medication, they are not sure about that, they can refer it back again, also with a clear-cut referral and a reason for the referral. Okay. And also after having a nice conversation with the patient, again, reassuring the expectations, everything that can be also managed before they're going back to the specialist care.
Perhaps you can advise us on how you would apply the 10-step plan. So Elizabeth says, I'm 61 and I have had migraine all my life, chronic since my 20s. Since June 2019, I have had non-stop migraine symptoms. The pain varies from mild to agonizing, but the other symptoms are continual: nausea, dizziness, and vertigo. The pain is horrible, but these ongoing symptoms are very debilitating. I don't know what's going on. So how could Elizabeth and her doctor use this 10-step plan?
I think that we are now managing. I mean, we are now in the step, I would say, when we need to talk about preventive treatment. Okay, because the most likely diagnosis here is the chronic migraine, and it is a very classical, situation when the patient starts with, let's say, frequent or less frequent migraine, a low frequency migraine, and then gradually evolves and become never-ending migraine. Every day headache and every day, let's say, other symptoms that could be some migraine features, could be not the migraine features. So it's a very, very important to say here that at the step that we have a diagnosis confirmed and it is a chronic migraine. And again, as a neurologist, I would always ask some extra questions to exclude the secondary cause. It is unlikely in this case because it gradually develops over the time, but any changes, must give some red flags in my mind just to check, to make sure that there is nothing wrong here. It is not a secondary headache. So it is a likely migraine, chronic migraine. So we need to, again, to decide where this patient should be seen. Because in any case, we need to talk about realistic objectives here, what we can do for this patient. And then we should accurately assess the acute treatment the patient gets, including the frequency of intake of acute medication, just to make sure that there is a no medication overuse here. And if there is a medication overuse here, it will bring us automatically to the step five when we have to decide about preventive medications. This will require also, in this particular case, I would say it should be a neurologist, because it's quite complicated. This required a review for all the medications patients previously failed, or maybe not failed, maybe it was effective, I don't know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, to assess that and then make a decision which of the preventive treatments we should introduce here. And I would say in this case, if patient tried, let's say, at least, let's say, 2 to 4, you know, different medications for different classes, this patient would be eligible for the third line medication. So let's say if this patient was in Denmark and patients tell me that, well, I have tried beta blockers, I didn't respond, I had a very bad side effect, and also tried topiramate. It worked, you know, for 2 months or 3 months, but then stopped working, but also have some mild cognitive problems, you know, after intake of the topiramate. Well, this patient is eligible for the third line medication directly in Denmark. No need for the, other second line medications that got mentioned in this consensus that we published. So in this case, yes. And then this case will also need a step 7, evaluation of treatment response and management of failure. Hopefully it will be effective, this medication. And then we can discuss about what to do on the long term, you know, how long we should see these patients. I would advise to see these patients for a year, something like that. And if it's stable, you know, it could be terminated and seen in the primary care. But if it is a specialized task, let's say treatment with biologics, this patient probably will stay. But if it's efficient, you know, the medications are effective, you don't need to see them every month or every 3 months. In fact, you can see them every 6 months. And at least in Denmark, we decided for the third line medications that we need a stopping rule and after 18 months, just to make sure that the migraine is fluctuating anyway, and it's kind of improving, and maybe we modify the disease and we don't need a treatment. But in most of the cases, unfortunately, patients return back to frequent migraine, and then we reintroduce again the new medication. So you can apply these 10 steps here, but I would say this particular case in the neurology practice.
So Dr. Ashina, who should consider this 10-step approach?
I think that the 10 steps approach should be considered by the general practitioners and neurologists.
And which patient groups should consider the 10-step approach?
This particular 10-step approach is for the patients with the common subtypes of migraine, migraine without aura and migraine with aura, and also patients with a chronic migraine.
Is it appropriate for children?
These steps are also appropriate for children, and that's why we also included managing migraine in special population with some modifications, of course, but basically the all main points are also very relevant for children as well. The only thing that when we talk about realistic objectives, we include also parents in this, let's say, situation, and sometimes we can also include teachers from the schools, you know, but this is usually conveyed by parents to teachers. The discussions with the physicians, you know, and the results of the assessment. But you can apply that, absolutely.
So this is a new approach or it's a new plan, maybe not a new approach. You may have just codified it in this plan. And so many people will be seeing a healthcare provider who isn't familiar with this. How would you recommend that they share this respectfully?
I think that, you know, first of all, this is an open access. So everybody can assess this article around the world. And one thing I would like to make sure that I'm not misunderstood, Paula, because when I say GPs and practitioners, again, I'm talking about the countries when these systems of care provide this service. But in many, many countries, this is not possible. Okay, so if we go to Africa, in some African countries, you know, there are some people not necessarily practicing headache medicine. They're general neurologists, or they're internal medicine people. You know, they see patients with a headache and they have also to treat them. So they can also use that, okay, because It is so easy and it is so intuitive. You have to follow that and you can actually provide with a minimum care in the countries that you live. So this is important that worldwide should be used, not only, let's say, in the rich countries. All countries, they can use that. In low-income countries, very important here. In some countries, unfortunately, around the world, we have absolutely no access to physician, okay? How the other, healthcare providers, they can use that, I don't know. Maybe it's a good idea just, to ask them about that in the countries when they are the first line seeing the patients, whether they can use that. I doubt a little bit because it is too specialized, but it is possible. Maybe with some modifications, because not all the drugs that I listed here are available in these countries. But it's important that you can use these logics, from one to the last step. And by using that, you can optimally, treat your patients, diagnose and treat your patients.
I have found that when I'm talking to a physician who is not a specialist about this, it helps me to print it out, since it's open access, as you point out, to print out the medical journal in which it appears. And we can add a link to this below your talk. Print out the medical journal so they can see it's from a respected medical journal and the physicians who are associated with it. And then they see the plan in front of them and they think about, well, this is how we could apply this, right? And so sometimes it's the patient bringing those things in, and you want to respect the doctor and their role and not, simply quote something that they're not familiar with. So that might help some people.
Many aspects of these steps, they are so obvious, Paula. Most of my colleagues, they use these steps, they used in the different, with some modifications, whatever. That was also at the whole point of having a consensus, experts together to agree upon something that we use, but we need to put it in a more stratified, systematic way so it is intuitively right, and also there is a logics here, and we can only do it together, and if I was alone and coming with something that will be questionable, that will be based only on my experience. But here we have many other really good physicians, talking together, working together, and come up with this consensus. This is important. That's why consensus papers are important.
Well, I agree, but I'll respectfully highlight a couple of things where I think communication breaks down between a doctor and a patient. One of those is in step three, in setting the right expectations. And another one is basically skipping preventive therapies that can oftentimes help people. And the other one is step seven. When there's treatment failure or complications that come up, some doctors just throw their hands up and say, well, there's nothing else I can do for you. And that just slays the patient who's like, oh, please, I'm counting on you to help me. So I do love this plan for that reason, that it helps create a dialogue between a patient and their physician in a way that ensures that those steps are not missed.
Absolutely. As I also pointed out, the step three is essential. It's so important, because this aligns, and realistic expectations, everything, the chemistry between physician and the patient is extremely important. It starts from there, okay? It's a best standing point, and if you're successful there, you will be happy and your patient will be happy.
Right. So if someone shares it with their healthcare provider and the provider rejects the idea or questions the evidence behind it, any tips for how to respond?
Well, it's a very difficult because, sometimes you meet some people, the ignorance, and denial of something. And it could be very individual. And I would say you can't change that. So, and you need to have another physician, but it could be also because of the lack of education, and the lack of respect also for this disease and specialty, you know, subspecialty of neurology, migraine and headache disorders. And but when I hear that, I always go back and see, maybe I have to do something more. Maybe I have to publish more. Maybe I have to go and teach more. Maybe I should push administration, universities, you know, to have more teaching hours about headache, you know. So it goes back to me, in fact, you know, people working in the headache field, people working for the professional organizations, you know, headache organizations. So we have to do more, you know, for this outreach and education. And in fact, that what we have in Denmark, we have a knowledge center for headache disorders. That I'm also leader of this knowledge center. And one of the tasks that we have is also promoting awareness, not only among the population, but also among the payers, and also GPs and neurologists, providing them educational materials, such as this material we have, maybe in a different forms and concise forms, so they can be better educated and they find this field, the headache medicine, interesting, because not so many diseases, Paula, you can make a difference in neurology. But here you can make a difference, okay? And science provided us so many evidence on specific biology, molecules, receptors, you know. We are in the fantastic time right now in the headache field. We have a classification. We have so many advantages, you know. We have to do it more. And it goes back to the professional organization, but also for the people working in the headache medicine, the headache field, to do more to educate their colleagues. It is never enough, I would say.
It's never enough. You do so much, and we all have a lot to do. And sometimes I think that these situations, these kinds of appointments are education one appointment at a time, and just simply leaving behind that plan for a time when the physician has more time to digest it, understand it, and think about it. Could help so many more patients who walk in after I do, then it's worth it. It's worth it. And maybe the next appointment will be better. And maybe if it's not, you need to find another physician. But these are real things that people deal with. So I thought it was important to bring up. Dr. Sheena, thank you so much, first of all, for all your advocacy, for your leadership in this field, and for creating this plan, which could really be a game changer for so many people struggling to operate within our healthcare system.
Thank you so much, Paula. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure.